Welcome back to part four of the Foundation Series, the place for those who are serious about building a business properly. In this episode, I want to expand on some of the paperwork requirements that we touched on in part three of this series. I'll start with some of the items that you need to think about before you start your business and progress to the things you need to keep track of after you've started your business, which will need to be discussed with your accountant or tax preparer. If you've not watched the first three parts of the Foundation Series, then I highly recommend that you go back and watch them first. Each video builds upon the previous one, and I want to make sure you get the most out of this information. It's taken me decades to learn and mentor others. You will find the link to part one of this series in the information below. Let's get started. Roger Pearson here, where we talk all about the basics of building a business. Today's subject is intended to give you some of the broad foundational knowledge for anyone building a business in the United States. I promise I'll try to keep this concise, even though I could probably talk about paperwork requirements and accounting for hours. Running business has a lot of moving parts. But before we get started, make sure you jot down any questions you may have and remember to post them in the comments section. Accounting is a broad subject, but we are going to look at accounting from the tax man's point of view. I've seen a lot of people lose money in the first few years of running their business because they don't have a good understanding of the Internal Revenue Tax Code. That causes them to not keep the proper records that can be used to mitigate their tax liability. While you may bring someone onto your team, like a tax advisor, accountant, or payroll company to handle that part of the business, remember that it is still the business owner's fault if a mistake is made, and you need to know the law to tell if they're doing it right for you. In the previous episode, we touched on some of the tax reasons you may want to choose one format or another. And I hope by the time you finish part four, you should have a fuller understanding of why that is so important. In order to report your business profit or loss to the IRS, you need to use the identification number. And the most common ones are the Social Security number and the Employer Identification Number, or EIN. Businesses are required to have an EIN if they have employees, if they have a qualified retirement plan, they operate their business as a corporation or partnership, or file returns or employment taxes or excise taxes. Now, while a sole proprietor can use their Social Security number for their business identification, I highly recommend you do not do this. The less you use your Social Security number, the less chance you have of identity theft. You may obtain an EIN free of charge by going online to www.irs.gov and searching on EIN, or by mailing or faxing a form SS-4, which is available on the irs.gov website also. You also need to be concerned with identification numbers when making payments to others. If you have employees, you must get their Social Security number from each of them. Record the name and Social Security number of each employee exactly as they are shown on the employee's Social Security card. If the employee's name is not correct as shown on the card, the employee should request a new card from the Social Security Administration. This may occur, for example, if the employee's name is changed due to marriage or divorce. If your employee does not have a Social Security number, they should file Form SS-5, Application for a Social Security Card, with the Social Security Administration. The form is available by going online to www.ssa.gov. And if you make payments to someone who is an independent contractor, and you must report the payments on an information return, you have to get that person's Social Security number or EIN. If you made reportable payments to an organization, such as a corporation or partnership, you must get their EIN number. You should request these by using Form W-9, Request for Taxpayer Identification Number and Certification. This form is also available by visiting irs.gov. You must figure your taxable income and file an income tax return based on an annual accounting period called a tax year. A tax year is usually 12 consecutive months, and there are two kinds. A calendar tax year is 12 consecutive months, beginning January 1st and ending December 31st, which is what most people use. And there's a fiscal tax year, which is any 12 consecutive months ending on the last day of any month except December. There's also a fiscal 52 to 53 week tax year that varies from 52 to 53 weeks, but does not have to end on the last day of the month. Fiscal tax years are normally only used by large corporations or partnerships because of the restrictions put on them. You adopt your choice of tax year the first time you file an income tax return for your business, either a calendar year or a fiscal year. Be aware that you have not adopted a tax year if you merely do any of the following. You filed an application for an extension of time to file a return. You filed an application for an EIN, or you paid estimated taxes for the tax year. You should be aware that once you've adopted your tax year, you have to get IRS approval to change it and have a compelling financial reason to do it. To get approval, you must file Form 1128, the application to adopt, change, or retain a tax year. An accounting method is simply a set of rules used to determine when and how income and expenses are reported. You also choose an accounting method for your business when you file your first income tax return, and there are three methods to choose from. Under the cash method, you report income in the tax year you receive it. You usually deduct or capitalize expenses in the tax year you actually pay for them. Under the accrual method, you report income in the tax year you earn it, even though you may receive payment for it in a later year. You deduct or capitalize expenses in the tax year that you incur them, whether or not you pay them that year. And then under the hybrid method, you use the accrual method for inventories, purchases, and sales, but you use the cash method for operating expenses like rents. If you need inventories to show income correctly, you must generally use an accrual method of accounting for purchases and sales. Inventories include goods held for sale in the normal course of business. They also include raw materials and supplies that physically will become part of merchandise intended for sale by manufacturers. This produces the cost of goods section on a tax return because you only get to deduct products when you sell them, not when you purchase them. This is also why if you keep an inventory, you must do a complete inventory at the end of every tax year to determine how much you can deduct. Not doing a year-end inventory is one of the biggest mistakes I see a new business owner do. You must use the same accounting method to figure your taxable income and to keep your books. You must also use an accounting method that clearly shows your income. In general, any accounting method that consistently uses accounting principles suitable for your trade or business clearly shows income. If you own more than one business, you can use a different accounting method for each business as long as the method clearly shows your income. Each business must be reported using its own EIN number. As with your business tax year, once you have set up your accounting method, you must get IRS approval before you can change it to another method. And this can result in restating inventories and other costs, so should not be done without the help of an accountant specializing in small business tax accounting. The form of business you operate determines what taxes you must pay and how you must pay them. There are four general types of taxes: income tax, self-employment tax, employment tax, or excise taxes. Let's briefly look at each of them. All businesses except partnerships and S corporations must file an annual income tax return. Partnerships and S corporations file information returns and issue K-1s, as we discussed in part 3 of this series. You must pay the income taxes as you earn them or receive income during the year. An employee usually has income withheld from his or her pay, but if the type of income you receive does not have withholding, you're responsible for paying the estimated taxes. The rules generally state that you must have prepaid at least 90% of the current year's tax liability or 110% of the previous year's tax liability, or you're going to be assessed a penalty. Estimated taxes, which include income, Social Security, and Medicare, are generally paid 4 times a year based on what you think you will owe for the previous quarter. This is why it's so necessary to have some type of bookkeeping system that shows you your net profit at all times. For sole proprietors, partners, and S-corporation shareholders, you generally have to make estimated tax payments if you expect to owe tax of $1,000 or more when you file your yearly tax return. You use IRS Form 1040-ES to figure and pay your estimated taxes. For C corporations, you generally have to make estimated tax payments if the corporation expects to owe a tax of $500 or more when it files its tax return. You use Form 1120-W to figure the estimated taxes, and you must deposit the payments, as I'll explain later in this video. Self-employment tax, also known as SE tax or payroll taxes, is a Social Security and Medicare tax for individuals who work for themselves, primarily sole proprietors, partners, or S corporation shareholders. You must pay SE tax and file Schedule SE if either of the following applies: your net profits from self-employment were $400 or more, or you had church employee income of $108.28 or more. If you have employees, you have to be concerned with employment taxes. These are Social Security and Medicare taxes, federal income tax withholding, federal unemployment tax, and state unemployment taxes. You can learn all about these from IRS Publication 15 Circular E, or if you have agricultural employees, get Publication 51 Circular A from the IRS.gov website. These guides will explain your tax responsibilities as an employer. Remember that even if you use a payroll service to handle these matters, it's still your fault if a mistake is made, and you need to know the law to tell if they're doing it right. Remember that you figure how much federal income tax to withhold from each wage payment by using the Form W-4 when you hired your employees. You also need to put in your budget the employer's matching half of the Social Security and Medicare taxes. The federal unemployment tax is part of the federal and state program under the Federal Unemployment Tax Act that pays unemployment compensation to workers who lose their jobs. You report and pay this tax separately from Social Security, Medicare, and federal income tax. The employer pays the tax, but usually only on the first $7,000 worth of wages. And you report these taxes on Form 940. The form number for the state unemployment differs by state. When you hire employees, have them fill out the Form I-9 and Form W-4. The Form I-9 verifies that each employee is legally eligible to work in the United States, and you can get the form from the USCIS.gov website. Each employee must also fill out a Form W-4, which will show you the filing status and withholding allowances, so you can figure the amount of income tax to withhold from your employees' wages. Now, after the calendar year is over, you must furnish copies of Form W-2, wage and tax statement, to each employee whom you paid wages during the year by January 31st. You must also send copies to the Social Security Administration by January 31st to avoid penalties. Finally, there are excise taxes you may have to pay and forms you have to file if you do any of the following: manufacture or sell certain types of products, operate certain types of businesses, use various kinds of equipment, facilities, or products, or receive payment for certain services. You'll find a description for each of these in IRS Publication 510. The form you have to file depends on what you're reporting. For instance, the federal excise taxes reported on Form 720 consist of several broad categories of taxes, including environmental taxes, communications and air transportation taxes, fuel taxes, taxes on the first retail sale of heavy trucks, trailers, or tractors, or manufacturer taxes on the sale or use of a variety of different articles. Form 2290 is for an excise tax on certain trucks, tractors, and buses used on public highways. The tax applies to vehicles having a taxable gross weight of 55,000 pounds or more. And Form 730 is for businesses that accept wages to conduct wagering pools or lotteries. And Form 11C is to register for any wagering activity and to pay the federal occupational tax on wagering. There's also sets of rules for depositing taxes. You generally have to deposit employment taxes, certain excise taxes, and corporate taxes before you file your return, and there's a couple of ways you can do that. Generally, when total deposits of Social Security, Medicare, and withheld income taxes during the previous tax years exceed a certain amount, you're required to deposit taxes through the Electronic Federal Tax Payment System, known as the EFTPS. Any business that has a federal tax obligation and requests a new EIN is automatically enrolled in EFTPS now. Through the mail, the business will receive an EFTPS PIN package that contains instructions for activating its EFTPS enrollment. Even if you're not required to make deposits with the EFTPS, you may still enroll in the system, which will allow tax deposits without coupons, paper checks, or visits to an authorized depository. If a business is not required to make deposits by EFTPS, it can make deposits with an authorized financial institution or mail them. Either way, these deposits must be accompanied by a deposit coupon. And usually a mailed deposit will be considered timely if the taxpayer establishes that it was mailed in the United States at least 2 days before the due date. You may be charged a penalty for not making deposits when due, unless you have reasonable cause. Make sure you include your EIN, type of tax, and the tax period for the payment on your check. You use Form 8109 Federal Tax Deposit Coupon to deposit taxes, and on each coupon you must show the deposit amount, the type of the tax, and the period for which you are making a deposit, and your telephone number, using a separate coupon for each tax and each tax period. You must include a coupon with each deposit you make. If you apply for an EIN number and have a federal tax obligation, you will be mailed one deposit coupon. Then you order additional coupons by calling 1-800-829-4933. If you make or receive payments in your business, you may have to report them to the IRS on information returns. The IRS compares the payments shown on the information return and each person's income tax return to see if the payments were included in income, which is why you must give a copy of each information return you are required to file to the recipient or payer by January 31st. The most common information returns include the 1099 NEC, which is used when you make payments of $600 or more for services performed for your business by people not treated as your employees, such as subcontractors, attorney, accounts, or directors. Form 1099 Miscellaneous, which is used when you make rent payments of $600 or more other than rents paid to real estate agents, prizes and awards of $600 or more that are not for services, such as winnings on TV or radio shows, or payments to certain crew members by operators of fishing boats. You can also use 1099 Miscellaneous to report your sales of $5,000 or more of consumer goods to a person for resale anywhere other than in a permanent retail establishment. Form W-2 reports payments to your employees, such as wages, tips, and other compensation, withheld income, Social Security and Medicare taxes, and advanced earned income payments. Form 8300, if you receive more than $10,000 in cash in one transaction or two or more related business transactions. Cash includes U.S. and foreign coin, currency, cashier's checks, and money orders. There's Form 1065 and K-1, which shows a partnership's income and the breakdown of each partner's share of profits and losses. And Form 1020S and the K-1, which show an S corporation's income and the breakdown of each shareholder's share of profits and losses. The law provides penalties for not filing returns or paying taxes as required. Criminal penalties may be imposed for willful failure to file taxes, tax evasion, or making a false statement. If you don't file your tax return by the due date, the penalty is based on the tax not paid by the due date. If you do not pay your taxes by the due date, you will have to pay a penalty for each month or part of a month that the taxes are not paid. The penalty for not filing on time is a lot larger than the penalty for not paying on time, so be sure to file even if you can't afford to pay it on time. If you do not withhold income, Social Security or Medicare taxes from employees, or if you withhold taxes but do not deposit them or pay them to the IRS, you are going to be subject to a penalty for unpaid tax plus interest. Depositing the taxes late can also subject you to a penalty. A penalty applies if you do not file information returns by the due date, if you do not include all required information, or if you report incorrect information. A penalty applies if you do not furnish the required statement to a payee by the due date, if you do not include all required information, or if you report incorrect information. While you can apply for a waiver for some of these penalties if caused by things outside of your control, it's best to just file everything when it's due and not have to worry about paying the government even more money that you can't afford. Make sure you're discussing these deadlines with your accountant or tax advisor. In this last section, I want to go over how to handle certain business expenses. These are some expenses that are of interest to people starting a business or to check that you're doing it right in an existing business. Business startup costs are the expenses you incur before you actually begin a business operation. Your business startup costs will depend on the type of business you're starting, and they can include costs for advertising, travel, surveys, and training. These costs are generally called capital expenses. Although you usually recover costs for assets that have a standard life of more than a year, like machinery or office equipment, through depreciation, which we'll discuss in a minute, for new businesses, you can elect to deduct up to $5,000 of business startup costs and $5,000 of organizational costs paid before the business starts, the first year you file your taxes. The $5,000 deduction is reduced by the amount your total startup or organizational costs exceed $50,000, so keep that in mind. Any remaining costs must be amortized or spread out over 15 years. Startup costs are expenses connected with setting up or investigating the creation and purchase of a trade or business. These expenses occur before the trade or business begins operations. Now, startup costs must be capitalized or amortized because they're not incurred in carrying on a trade or business since it hasn't started yet. And they include things like the survey of potential markets or advertising the opening of the business or consulting with other professionals or professional fees paid in connection with starting the business, wages to employees being trained for the new business, analysis of possible facilities, labor force, supplies, travel and related expenses to secure distributors, suppliers, or customers. Now, organizational costs, on the other hand, are expenses incurred in the formative and launch stages of your business, and they include things like attorney's fees, state incorporation costs, local occupational licenses, the cost of temporary directors, the cost of organizational meetings. And you can find out more information about amortizing startup costs and organizational costs in Chapter 7 of IRS Pub 535. Now, I could probably do an entire episode on depreciation and why it is important to know how to use it to your benefit. But for now, here's the abbreviated version. If property you acquire to use for your business has a useful life that extends substantially beyond the year it is placed in service, you generally cannot deduct the entire cost in the year you purchased it. You must spread the cost over more than one tax year and deduct part of it each year. This method of deducting the cost of business property is called depreciation. Business property you must depreciate includes things like office furniture, buildings, or machineries and equipment. And as with most things in the U.S. tax code, there's an exemption to every rule. Rather than depreciating property over several years, Section 179 of the tax code allows a business to expense in the year of purchase any qualifying property that is used more than 50% in a trade or business and acquired from an unrelated party. The Section 179 election is made on an item-by-item basis, and the total amount of purchases that you can use for a Section 179 deduction changes from year to year. Why is this important to you? Well, used properly, depreciation in Section 179 can help you decrease your tax liability. The federal government has created a chart that lists the average lifespan of all major categories of assets. Let's take the case of a computer that has an asset life of 5 years. You have the choice when doing your tax return to write off the entire cost of the computer in the year you bought it, or deduct part of it over 5 years. And to determine which is best for you, you would first prepare your tax return using the standard depreciation charge to arrive at a net profit. Then if you had a great year and need additional deductions that year to bring down your tax liability, you could use the Section 179 to accelerate the expense and reduce your taxes. However, if you had a lousy year and expect next year to be a lot better, then it's probably best to push the deductions into future years when you're going to need them more. And there's also two other methods that can be used to manipulate your tax liability called special depreciation and the safe harbor rules for depreciable assets under $2,500. I see too many tax preparers not having this conversation with their clients, which is why I included an entire chapter to it in my advanced courses. The rules for business use of your home are probably the most misunderstood parts of tax accounting and can only be used by those filing Schedule C, which are sole proprietorships. To deduct expenses related to the business use of part of your home, you must meet specific requirements, and even then your deduction may be limited. And to qualify to claim expenses for business use of your home, you must meet both of the following tests. First, your use of the business part of your home must be used only for your business. You can't also use it for a guest or TV room. It must be used on a regular basis. It must be for your trade or business. And second, the business part of your home must be one of the following. It must be your principal place of business, which means that you use it exclusively and regularly for administrative and management activities of your trade or business, and you have no other fixed location where you conduct substantial administrative or management activities for your trade or business. Or it must be a place where you meet or deal with patients, clients, or customers in the normal course of your trade or business. Or it must be a separate structure not attached to your home that you use in connection with your trade or business. As I mentioned, you must use a specific area of your home only for your trade or business. The area used for business can be a room or other separately identifiable space. The space does not have to be marked off by a permanent partition, and you do not meet the requirements of the exclusive use test if you use the area in question both for business and for personal purposes. The only exceptions to this are you use part of your home for the storage of inventory or product samples, such as the garage, and then you just use part of the square footage of the garage that you'd use for that. Or you use your home as a daycare facility. Home office expense can be figured one of two ways. The first is to take a percentage of expenses. Home office expenses include such things as rent or mortgage interest, property taxes, utilities, certain house maintenance and homeowners renter's insurance, house depreciation, as well as expenses specific to the office area. The cost of painting your kitchen doesn't count, but the cost of painting your office would. The amount of household expenses that can be claimed under the percentage formula is figured by multiplying the percentage of your house that is used for business based on the square footage times the total expenses. Or, under the safe harbor rule, you can just take $5 a square foot of the office area up to 300 square feet. Most of the time, this actually gives you a larger deduction for a lot less work. If you use your car or truck in your business, you can deduct the cost of operating and maintaining it. You generally can deduct either the actual expenses or use the standard mileage rate. If you deduct actual expenses, you can deduct the cost of the following items: depreciation, lease payments, registration, garage rent, licenses, repairs, gas, oil, tires, insurance, parking fees, and tolls. Now, if you use your vehicle for both business and personal purposes, then you must divide your expenses between business and personal use, and you do this by keeping a mileage log. Now, there's no definitive format for this log, but it must include the following: the date, the business purpose of the trip, such as which client you saw or what store you went to pick up office supplies, etc. and the number of miles it took to get there and back. For example, if you're a sole proprietor of a flower shop and you drove the van 20,000 miles during the year, 16,000 were used for delivering flowers and 4,000 for your personal use, well, you can claim only 80% of the cost of operating your van as a business expense. Now, instead of figuring actual expenses, you may be able to use the standard mileage rate to figure the deductible cost of operating your car, van, pickup, or panel truck for business purposes. You use the standard mileage rate for a vehicle you own or lease. The standard mileage rate is a specified amount of money you can deduct for each business mile you drive. It's announced annually by the IRS. And to figure your deduction, you simply multiply your business miles from your mileage log by the standard mileage rate for that year. Now, if you use the standard mileage rate, you cannot deduct your actual expenses except for parking fees, tolls, and interest on your car loan, and certain state and local taxes. For the vast majority of people, the standard deduction is going to give you a greater deduction than the actual expenses. If you want to use the standard mileage rate for a car you own, you must choose it in the first year the car is available for use in your business. In later years, you can choose to use either the standard mileage or the actual expenses. The exception is if you use the standard mileage rate for the car you lease, then you must choose it for the entire lease period, including renewals. If you choose actual expenses the first year you put a vehicle in use, then you must use it every year thereafter. Since the standard mileage rate usually gives you a better deduction, this is an important decision. There's also one restriction here. If your business operates five or more vehicles, such as a limo, taxi, or delivery company, then you must use actual expenses. And remember, regardless of which method you use, you need to keep a mileage log unless you use the vehicle 100% for business or the business owns the vehicle, in which case the tax year beginning odometer and tax year ending odometer reading will do. What I've tried to do is to present you with the things that you need to be aware of and make sure you take into account or need to be discussing with those you hire to help you. If done correctly, they can save you thousands in taxes and lost profits for your business. In the next video of the series, we will get into the framework of the different types of marketing programs that are available for the business community. So be sure to hit the subscribe button and notifications so you don't miss the rest of this business training. And if you know of any small business people who could benefit from this knowledge, please consider sharing it. And remember, leave those comments about subjects you wish to learn more about or clarifications on what we've already discussed. I really do read them all.